is Wednesday, April 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, French President Emmanuel Macron tells U.S. lawmakers to keep the Iran nuclear deal intact. Israel cancels deportation orders against African migrants, and high school students in Virginia learn what is real or fake news. It's all ahead. French President Emmanuel Macron addressed the U.S. Congress Wednesday. The speech concludes the first state visit by a foreign leader during President Donald Trump's presidency. Trump and First Lady Melania Trump hosted a lavish state dinner for Macron and his wife, Brigitte Macron, on Tuesday night for more than 100 guests, including numerous Trump administration officials and leading U.S. corporate executives. In his speech to Congress, Macron condemned nationalism.
We can choose isolationism, withdrawal, and nationalism. This is an option. It can be tempting to us as a temporary remedy to our fears. But closing the door to the world will not stop the evolution of the world. It will not douse but inflame the fears of our citizens. We have to keep our eyes wide open to the new risks right in front of us. I'm convinced that if we decide to open our eyes wider, we will be stronger. We will overcome the dangers. We will not let the rampaging work of extreme nationalism shake a world full of hopes for greater prosperity.
He also called for efforts to halt climate change.
I believe in building a better future for our children, which requires offering them a planet that is still habitable in 25 years.
And Macron said the United States should not pull out of the international pact with Iran to restrain its nuclear weapons development.
But it is true to say that this agreement may not address all concerns. And very important concerns. This is true. But we should not abandon it without having something substantial and more substantial instead. That's my position.
VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain spoke with me about the warm relationship between Macron and President Trump, unlike the president's apparent cool relationship with German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Yes, that's right, Sarah, and that has sort of been the talk of the town this week here in Washington, with more sort of repeats of their very long handshakes, which we saw when President Trump was in France, and hand clasping of all different sorts, and kisses on the cheeks, and hugs, and even President Trump in one moment in the Oval Office whisking a little speck of dandruff off of Macron's jacket and saying, you're perfect, I want you to be perfect. So, yes, body language experts and other analysts have been watching this very closely and said it's sort of it's a very warm relationship. The two obviously like each other and get along. They had 3 days together here, but it's also a bit of a sort of a power play, some are thinking, of, you know, a bit of a sort of a male dominance with all of these physical gestures and everything going on.
Because certainly in areas such as Iran, you know, the Iran nuclear deal, and also in regard to possible, you know, trade tariffs, there's quite to say nothing of climate change, there's quite a few differences between them.
Yes, that's right. And we just had the French president speaking to Congress, and then without really mentioning Trump's name or doing any sort of eye poking, he gave a very passionate defense of global institutions, the post-World War II world order, which he said that the United States had built, multilateralism and the Paris Climate Change Accord, and a lot of things that President Trump has been against. So in this speech, and it was interesting that you had, a lot of the times, you had both Republicans and Democrats applauding when he spoke against some extreme nationalism and that sort of thing. So as you said, there are very important and major ideological differences between the two. But it would seem that Macron has understood how to just sort of take it issue by issue. Now, whether or not he will be able to change President Trump's mind to keep him from pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, that remains to be seen.
And some observers have said, in a way, Macron is sort of a European outreach to President Trump, that there's a way of sort of trying to bridge that divide.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I'm sure that he and German Chancellor Merkel talked and sort of planned and plotted their agenda, and both for both of them, as you say, this Iran nuclear deal is very important, with a deadline of May 12th with President Trump making his decision. And I'm sure that both Macron and Merkel, that is their goal. But it would seem we've seen a bit of a frosty relationship between Trump and Merkel with the German chancellor right after Trump was elected, saying Germany would work with the United States, but doing a bit of lecturing and saying, you know, as long as President Trump abides by the rule of law and democratic principles, and I don't think that went down very well. And we have sort of just the opposite body language between President Trump and Chancellor Merkel.
And Chancellor Merkel will be visiting the United States. And as you said, there seems to be, it's a different dynamic there, a more cool relationship.
Yes, it does seem to be a cooler relationship. And she seems to stand for some of the things that President Trump doesn't like. He's mentioned, you know, Germany taking in what he thought was way too many refugees, and accidentally or not, Chancellor Merkel now stands for a lot of those values of openness and taking in refugees and pro regulations to help the environment and that sort of thing. So they do have a lot of ideological differences, and I'm not sure if it's because she is a powerful woman or why it is that that relationship seems to be so much cooler.
And also recently, the United States and Britain and France took part in conducting strikes, attacks against the Syrian government. On the other hand, the Germans were not involved in that.
Yes, that's right. And, yeah, Germany is sort of walking a fine line. They are criticizing the Russians and the Syrians, but yet not participating in strikes. And that's another thing where I think President Trump felt that, you know, he and the French president agreed, and France sort of showed its solidarity, whereas Germany didn't in that point.
VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain. Chancellor Merkel visits President Trump on Friday. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's going on?
Well, there's really no question what's got people talking, not just in the United States, but really around the world. And that was Mr. Macron's address to Congress that you've just been talking about, not just his visit, but his address. It was substantive, and lots of people are talking about it. Let's just share some thoughts here. Somebody who calls themselves Skull Sister: Macron is absolutely making a fool of everything 45, referring to President Donald Trump, who's the 45th U.S. president, has done and said for the last 2 years, and it is beautiful. Hashtag Macron. That's one that's trending strongly at this hour. I miss having an educated leader who cares more about himself than, who cares more about the world than himself and dollars. Here's Randy. Close your eyes. We're listening to a new, fresh version of President Obama. This speech is giving me strength and hope for our world. The leader of the free world stands before us. Hashtag Macron. So a big fan there. It's Peter Finnegan. It's nice to see an articulate president with an understanding of world politics and economics and a vision of how to move forward addressing both houses of the United States Congress. It's been a couple of years, and of course, hashtag Macron. Now, not everybody is in agreement. Joe Walsh, who was a former member of Congress, Republican member of Congress, now a commentator, has this to say: hashtag Macron slams nationalism and President Trump's America First agenda in his speech to the U.S. Congress. Hey, Macron, how about you spend more time worrying about the Islamism that has overrun your country and spend less time criticizing ours. And here's Angie Kay. The U.S. has done more to protect the planet than any other country in the world and will continue to lead in this effort, but we will not bear the financial brunt of it. The Paris Accord is about distribution of America's wealth, nothing more. That there, a reference to one of the key topics in the meeting between these two world leaders, that of climate change and the Paris Accords. So he has made an impact, and he's got people talking, whether positive or negative, but clearly people were paying attention.
Yeah, thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The Supreme Court signals support for President Trump's travel ban. The United States is investigating alleged atrocities against Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims. Donors pledge more than $4 billion in aid for Syria and neighboring countries. And the White House physician continues his fight to be the chief of the Veterans Administration. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
When you visualize a DNA structure, it's probably the well-known double helix that was revealed in 1953 by James Watson and Francis Crick. Australian scientists now say that they have been able to observe and identify a totally new DNA structure inside of a living cell. It's called iMotif. Rather than an elegant-looking double helix, the researchers say the new structure looks more like a twisted knot of DNA. The new iMotif structure has actually been seen and studied before, but under artificial laboratory conditions, not in an actual living cell. In the years since the classic double helix DNA structure was first shown, scientists have determined that short bursts of DNA can be found in other shapes as well. It's thought that the different shaped DNA might help determine just how and when the genetic code is read. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, high school students in Virginia learn to beware of fake news. The Israeli government has abandoned plans to deport thousands of African migrants who entered the country illegally after the last plan repatriating them back to Africa fell through. The news was greeted with relief by two of the more than 35,000 African migrants, mostly males from Eritrea and Sudan, who slipped in through Egypt.
It was a difficult time for the asylum seekers here in Israel on the matter of being deported or being imprisoned for a lifetime. And it's good news to hear that the first deportation is canceled. And also it's a time that there should be a humanitarian solution for the asylum seekers.
I am very happy to see the deportation policy is canceled. And now it is the right time to the Israeli government to give a solution for the asylum seeker came from Africa, a refugee status, or to answer their asylum claim application.
For now, the Africans, some of whom have lived in Israel more than a decade, will be able to renew their residency permits every 60 days. Since 2013, a portion of the migrants agreed to a voluntary program that sent them to Rwanda and Uganda. Many insist they are escaping war and rights abuse. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, under political pressure to do something, tweeted he intends to reopen a remote detention facility while lawmakers may consider new legislation to deport the migrants. Earlier, Mr. Netanyahu canceled a plan reached with the UN Refugee Agency to send half the migrants to the West and allow the rest to stay. Russell Stone, a professor emeritus at the American University Center for Israel Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the issue poses a moral dilemma for many Israelis.
Those who are interested in human rights, as well as Holocaust survivors, who are very sensitive to the plight of refugees. On the other hand, the right-wing elements of the Israeli government are insisting that the Prime Minister take a hard line position on this, so it's become a source of controversy between right and left within Israel.
Is this a growing issue in Israel?
It's an issue that's been there. The migration itself has virtually stopped as Israel succeeded in more or less sealing the border with Egypt, which was the way they were coming in. But there has been a failure to integrate these refugees into Israeli society, so that many of them are living in very poor areas on the margins of society. Some have gotten involved in illegal activities, and some have been either directly put into detention centers as they cross the border, or have been placed in detention as a result of breaking laws.
The Netanyahu government tried to resolve the matter, either sending them to African countries like, well, what has been mentioned is Rwanda and Uganda, or somehow splitting them, sending them to a third party and absorbing the rest.
The latest deal that fell through was a deal to get more developed countries like Canada and others to take about half of them, together with some payments to permit them to reestablish themselves and to reintegrate the other half into Israeli society. This created opposition from the right, which caused Prime Minister Netanyahu to back down on the plan almost immediately after he announced it.
Apparently, there's still the practice ongoing of what's called voluntary expulsions.
It's not so voluntary in that they are being pressured to agree to leave together with payments, but the numbers who are willing to leave are relatively small under this circumstance.
Do you have any notion as to how this immigration issue, this migration issue from Africa, will eventually be resolved?
It's hard to know. On the one hand, Israel prides itself in being a humanitarian society that is sympathetic to the rights of refugees. On the other hand, the African immigrants are fairly visible within Israeli society, and to the extent that they are not effectively integrated in a socioeconomic sense, having jobs and decent housing conditions, it will remain a visible problem.
Meanwhile, Israel continues to absorb Ethiopians who claim a Jewish heritage. The government in February approved the admittance of another 1,000 this year. The Times of Israel said some 8,000 Ethiopians are waiting to emigrate. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. The term fake news is heard a lot these days, especially from President Trump, other politicians, journalists, and also posted on social media platforms such as Twitter. Some high school students in the United States and around the world are getting a better understanding of fake and real news by learning literacy media skills in the classroom. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to a high school in Arlington, Virginia.
18 times.
Here at Wakefield High School in Arlington, Virginia, these seniors are learning to identify false or misleading information.
What's the big deal about people being misinformed?
Social studies teacher Patricia Hunt is using a digital course called Checkology to give students real-world examples of news and information that is either factual, misleading, or just plain false. Take February's high school shooting in Parkland, Florida, where 14 students and three teachers were killed. She asks the students to think about whether the rumors that swirled after the shooting were actually real.
Students are bombarded with information, and they are also bombarded with so-called news, fake news, viral rumors, and misinformation. My hope in my lessons is that they will be able to identify quality journalism when they see it, and they'll be able to identify unfair, unbalanced, fake propaganda and the like when they see it too.
Studies have shown that teens get most of their information from social media, and they are more likely to believe the information they get from their friends. Ellen Miller is the founder of the nonprofit News Literacy Project, which includes Checkology.
I've really been struck by how students tend to see all information as created equal. If they're younger, they may think that if somebody put it on the internet, they verified it, and it's all true, and they're inclined to believe it and to share it. By the time they're in high school, they're often more cynical, and they may feel that it's all equally driven by bias, by agenda. What's missing is that critical thinking skill to know what to do with all of that information.
This student plans to look at social media with a more critical eye.
Now I know how to decipher what's real and what's fake and what to look for.
What we want the students to take away is the ability to assess the credibility of all news and information they encounter.
And it seems to be working.
I learned about fact-checking and ways to find false news, you know, like by headlines and seeing if there's publishers.
I think I'll be able to kind of go through news a lot better. I'll be able to kind of rest easier knowing that I'm not going to be tricked as easily.
Thousands of educators are using the digital Checkology courses in the U.S. and in 90 other countries, helping students recognize for themselves
fake media, fake news,
if what they are hearing or seeing is true or not. Deborah Block, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
Where did you get that? And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 25th, we observe World Malaria Day. It is an occasion to recognize the global effort to effectively control and eventually eliminate this devastating disease. This year's theme is Ready to Beat Malaria. In 2016, 216 million people became sick with malaria, and over 445,000 died. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports that 90% of malaria cases were reported in Africa, as were 91% of malaria-related deaths. The good news is malaria is preventable and curable. Over the last nearly two decades, there has been a coordinated global effort to eliminate the disease altogether. Between 2000 and 2015, new cases among populations at risk fell by 29% globally. After an unprecedented period of success in controlling this disease, it is clear that there is more work ahead. We continue to focus on prevention. Among the most successful weapons we have against this deadly disease are insecticide-treated nets and indoor spraying with insecticides to kill the mosquitoes that carry the illness, causing parasite. These preventative tools, when coupled with strategies to prevent malaria during pregnancy, low-cost diagnostic tools, and highly effective malaria treatments, dramatically reduce death and disease from malaria. Yet much more needs to be done to address remaining challenges, including the emergence of drug-resistant malaria. The WHO has developed the Global Technical Strategy for Malaria, which provides a technical framework for all endemic countries as they work towards control and eventually elimination. The first goals to be reached by the year 2030 are to reduce malaria incidence by at least 90%, reduce malaria mortality rates by at least 90%, eliminate the disease in at least 35 countries, and prevent a resurgence of malaria in all countries that are malaria-free. If we are to be successful, donors must help fund the effort. The United States government has been involved in global malaria activity since the 1950s, and today is the largest donor to global malaria efforts, including through its President's Malaria Initiative and U.S. contributions to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Still, if the 2030 targets of the Global Technical Strategy are to be achieved, total funding must increase substantially. On this day, we call on our friends and partners around the globe to reaffirm their commitment.